Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Wild Alaska Pollock, the fish of the future. Learn more and try a free sample at wildakpollock.com.
I'm one of HRN's interns, Nina Medvinskaya, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week's topic, the marriage of food and danger. Sometimes, danger lurks in the food that we eat.
So instead of saying what is poisonous, I'd rather say what's not, because it's literally just the flesh and the fins.
Food poisoning doesn't just threaten our bodies, but it endangers our environment as well.
The emissions of JBS, combined with the other top five meat companies, exceed the annual emissions of Exxon, Shell, or BP.
For more, tune into this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. So, happy Hanukkah, and welcome to holiday party season. It seems like there's a holiday party for every organization, every family, every friend group, every workplace. So, if you are hosting one, hang tight, because we have a lot of ideas for what to cook. But first off, if you ever tried cooking for a crowd, whether it's holidays or not, and if you tried to scale up a recipe that was meant for maybe 4 to 5 people and tried to turn into something that was meant for instead maybe 12 or 20 people, you might have found that sometimes that just doesn't always work. And, you know, it's easy to kind of roll it off your back when it's, you know, just for yourself. But when you've just bought ingredients for like 12 to 20 people, it's a little harder to swallow. So I'm really excited that there's a cookbook really devoted to the subject of cooking practically for a crowd, and filled with crowd-pleasing recipes. So this book is by someone who knows quite a thing or two about cookbooks. She has been a cookbook editor at Chronicle Books for 18 years. She is now a book packager and content producer with her own company called Connected Dots Media. So welcome to the show, Leslie Jonath.
Hello.
Hello. So I forgot to introduce the name of your book. You teamed up with dozens of chefs, as well as the San Francisco nonprofit 18 Reasons, to create this book called Feed Your People, Big Batch, Big Hearted Cooking and Recipes to Gather Around. It is really heavy, too. I'm holding it right now, and it's like, okay. It's impressive.
It is a big book.
It's a big book. And I love that it's focusing on how to feed many. And, you know, I was trying to think of any cookbooks I've seen like this. Had you seen this before? And or did you feel like it was lacking?
Well, you know, it's funny. I had seen some books about big batch gathering, but, you know, I like to cook for big groups of people. I'd rather cook for a big group of people than a small group of people. I just feel like it's more festive. Mm-hmm. With my own family, I'm always thinking, like, okay, just popcorn. But when I have a party, I feel like that's where it's really fun to cook for big groups of people. It makes it much more alive, and that's where I love to cook.
Yeah, this book is like also really a celebration of not just the, you know, practical tips of entertaining or like cooking for crowds, but it's also really celebrating why it's important to gather around and all the community, you know, friendships that are made around it. Tell me a little bit about how you decided to start writing it.
It started at a party that I have every year called Vodka and latkes.
Wait, you just
vodka cut. And latkes. Yes, and it's, we call it celebrating the potato in all its forms.
Uh-huh.
So I started throwing this party, and I do it now. And I call my mother, and I say, "Hey, I'm having the party." And then she says, "I'm not doing it. There's no way I'm not doing it again."
Uh-oh.
And then 3 weeks later, she calls me and tells me she's made 200 latkes, and who's coming? And so then we have this big party, and my friend Anya Fernal makes brisket. And it's a little bit of a scam on my part because I have my mother make the latkes and my friend makes a brisket. And then my dad leads everybody in doing shots of vodka, which we do with pickle chasers.
Oh, wow.
And it's just so much fun. And every year, you know, people look forward to it. You get people call me in July and ask me what it's going to be. And I just had this moment where I thought, you know, there are certain we gather around that are, yeah, incidentally, big batch foods that just in themselves create a gathering. And mm-hmm. when I thought about that, I then became interested in looking around at other cultures, other traditions around what are the foods we gather around.
Yeah.
The impetus for the book.
I see. So the recipes, though, they're all contributed by an amazing chef or cookbook author themselves, such as, you know, dumpling recipe from Andrea Nguyen. There's paella. There's recipes from Alice Waters and Brian Terry and Yotam Ottolenghi. It's kind of like a who's who of like chefs and writers of food right now. But so the theme is something that is festive and meant for feeding a crowd. Is that the idea?
Yes, and also, you know, in my years as a cookbook author, I thought about all the chefs and cooks who I had met over the years, and there's something, for me, very moving around people.
The generosity of the cooks, right? Are you there?
Generosity.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Okay,
you
sorry.
Hear me?
It was a little...
Yes.
Okay, we got you now.
No, it's the generosity of the chefs and the cooks and the people who make food. It's people generally are, you know, they're feeders. They, mm-hmm. they feed others, and therefore there's a certain generosity that is always inherent. And of all the chefs and cooks I met, so many of them do this kind of, have some kind of tradition. I asked them, what are the foods you gather around? What do you gather your people around? And they gave me their dishes.
I love that. And it seems like in your head notes, introducing the chef and the recipe, they all seem really community-minded. Like there's the annual, it's a matzo ball recipe that you have from Myland Deli's Noah Bermanoff and Ray Cohen. And they do this annual Passover Seder for Share Our Strength and the No Kid Hungry campaign. So then there's a wonderful soup swap from, who was this?
Kathy
Gunst. Yeah. And that's
and
like...
Kathy is amazing. I mean, she did a book that's called Soup Swap that is absolutely wonderful and has, you know, she would have, everybody would bring a soup. And we did, when her book came out, she came to my house and we had a huge gathering at my house and I think 20 people showed up with different kinds of soups and it was just so much fun.
And I love the idea that you were saying that, you know, once... It's this like theme dinner, like your latkes and vodka. Vodkas? No, latkes.
Vodka.
Yeah.
Actually, it is vodkas because people bring different kinds of vodka. So it turns out that it is vodkas. You know, it's people bring the pickles and they bring vodkas. We supply the latkes and the brisket. So it can get quite loud.
Nice. Yeah. No, I was trying to make like a portmanteau of latkes and vodkas, and then I was like, wait, it sounds exactly the same. So, like, yeah, anyway. But yeah, I like the idea of like when you have this theme that people just know is going to happen, it's really exciting. And you kind of created this annual tradition that you can't give up now because your friends are calling you in July. So,
yeah. And, you know, there are certain things that, you know, dishes, there's a timpano, which is certain dishes that take a long time that you're not going to cook them because they're complicated unless it's for 20 people. So, you know, there's a timpano, which is by Viola Buttoni, who's in San Francisco and an amazing cooking teacher at Lovely. And it takes, you know, there are different components. You have to make the meatballs, you make the pasta frolla, you make the pasta, the tomato sauce. But if you do it in community, you don't do it by yourself, you actually have a party, and that's the actual gathering, is the party to make the food. So there's a lot of, I say in the book, you know, if there's one thing I want to say, one piece of advice, it's don't do it by yourself. Make it part of the party. Start the party early. People love to be included, and being included in the process of cooking makes them feel enlisted, makes them feel part of it. It's one of the key things that I love to do in any party I do.
Yeah, and some of the dishes, like the first section is dedicated to dishes like that, like so the empanada party or the dumpling party. There's the momos, the Tibetan momos that are fun to do together. So you're one person isn't doing the whole thing.
Yeah, and there's a tradition of that. You know, it, actually Christmas, there's the tamaladas, you know, where you sit and you, in Mexico and South America, you make tamales in community. And then you eat and you feed your community. So I loved, what I loved about the book was the way that the book, the process of making the book, the process of the food mirrored exactly what I was trying to create, which is how do you create community through food? How, you know, that's really important. It's not only eating together, but it's cooking together that makes us all feel like included.
Yeah, and that's something that 18 Reasons, the cooking school in San Francisco, that's what they really thrive on. It's a cooking school, but also they have the community dinners. And what was it like working with them?
It was amazing. I mean, I actually found them. I was thinking about, I wanted to work with a local nonprofit. I like the idea because you can have great impact if you work on a local level. And so I talked to Sarah Nelson, who's their executive director, and we decided that in order to test recipes, because you have to test the recipes for a cookbook, how are you going to, what are you going to do if you're testing for 20? Well, you got to have a party. So
freeze them, no.
Recipe. Well, like you said, that was my reason to do the book, was a lot of parties. But you do testing dinners at the at the space. They have a community space, and it holds between 30 and 40. So, you know, once every 2 months, we would have a dinner, and we did a chili night where we did a Gujarati chili by Preeti Mistry. We did a Rob Walsh's Texas chili, and we did a chili verde by Tracy Desjardins. Mm-hmm. And all of these chilies, you know, the Gujarati is vegan, you know, Texas chili is beef, and then you've got the other chili, the chili verde, which is pork, and they were stunning.
That's so brilliant.
It's really fun. We did a red beans and rice dinner with the recipes by Pablo Johnson, who's out of New Orleans, and he does these Monday night red beans and rice nights. And so sort of going back to the earlier point that you made, most of the people in the book are people who do this. They invite community. They work with nonprofits. They work with hunger relief. It's all about the idea of generosity and giving back and connecting people.
Mm-hmm. And they've generously shared their recipes in this book, too. So that's a good. One quick question, though. Were you ever nervous during these recipe testing dinners that, you know, by nature, they're not yet tested, right? Did anything go wrong? Was did you find something didn't work?
Well, it was a little nerve-wracking, but it was also good because the people who came to the dinners, we wanted their feedback. Mm. So, again, it made them feel enlisted. We said, these are recipe testing dinners. We want your feedback. The 18 Reasons has wonderful chefs on their staff. So, you know, they gave me feedback and volunteers gave feedback. Nothing really went wrong. There was one recipe that wasn't, I think, needed more salt. But again, it was one of those things where it was helpful. That's why we did the testing, was to find out what we needed to adjust.
Perfect. Yeah. That sounds really fun. I love that you have like one tip in here where you say, forego perfection in favor of connection. Not only does that rhyme, but that just sounds like a really good sort of mantra to keep in mind when you're when you're doing anything like this that could be nerve-wracking. So are you not a
most people are. Yeah. I think most people are really afraid of entertaining. They feel that they won't amazed at the amount of hesitation people have. I do too. But I think that, you know, people remember food and enjoy food. But what they really remember, I think it was Maya Angelou who said this, is like how they felt when they were in that with you. You know, so,
yeah.
So, you know, I think like, okay, so your apartment's a little bit cramped. But, you know, the best party I ever had was in a one-bedroom apartment where I lined up chairs and tables all the way through the hallway, through the kitchen, through the bedroom. People crammed around the table and they made lentil soup. And people still talk about that because it's a sense of kind of fun, cozy. It was so cozy.
Mm. And I bet you didn't break the bank, too, on that lentil soup for so many people. That's great.
Well, that's the thing. When you cook for a group of people, it can get expensive.
Yeah.
So a lot of the recipes in the book, you know, use humble ingredients. You know, pasta with tomato sauce, meatballs. You know, there's ways that you can feed many and not spend a lot of money. Certainly less expensive than going out. So
yeah.
I think that is there's a frugality to this kind of cooking.
And I mean, who can say no to latkes, even though it may cost less? It's just so festive and so fun. I want to talk a lot more about some of these recipes and also some do's and don'ts of throwing a party, but we're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wild Alaska Pollock, the fish of the future. Wild Alaska Pollock is incredibly delicious, highly nutritious, and perpetually sustainable. Among the last frontier's many natural wonders, Wild Alaska Pollock just might be the state's best-kept secret. This cousin to cod has lean, snowy white meat, delicate texture, and a mild flavor that makes it extremely versatile and tasty. Only pollock caught in Alaskan waters by U.S. fishermen can be labeled Wild Alaska Pollock. Unlike other pollock products, Wild Alaska Pollock is filleted and frozen just once within hours of being caught to preserve freshness, flavor, and texture. And now, food service professionals can try Wild Alaska Pollock for free. Request your sample at wildakpollock.com and discover the fish of the future. That's wildakpollock.com.
All right, we're back chatting more with some tips, wisdom, delicious inspiration for cooking for many with Leslie Jonath. She's the author of Feed Your People. So, you still there, Leslie?
I am.
Excellent. So, you started off talking about latkes, and I just wanted to share, and you mentioned that your mom would make them ahead of time and she would freeze like 200 or so. I just wanted to share that I have a friend who has a branded holiday party all around Swedish meatballs. And we know that, like, you know, every year on this night, we're going to all eat like dozens of Swedish meatballs. And he freezes them ahead and just makes them in his own time. So is that similar to your mom's approach to like making all these latkes weeks ahead?
Yes, making things ahead. So what she does is she fries off each batch, makes about 25, and she'll do two batches at a time. She'll fry them off. She puts them on a cookie sheet. Then she puts them in the freezer and freezes them. And then she takes them out of, it puts them into plastic Ziploc bags with, I think, paper towels between them.
So that,
mm-hmm. And then when she comes to my house, she'll have them, she'll bring it in a like a cooler with stacked with ice. And then when she's reheating them, she takes them out, she defrosts them for between like 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and then puts them back in the oven and just bakes them off until they get crispy and bubbly and then puts them out.
That's
really the thinking behind it is, you know, when you make latkes, it can be very, you know, that there's oil.
Yes.
It's messy. Mm-hmm. She can't talk to anybody. And people always want to eat more, you know, they want to eat two or three. So this is just highly efficient.
Yeah. And I love that, you know, I think you mentioned that she would, you know, do not all of them at the same day, you know, when she was making them ahead of time, but just like sort of in between, like cooking something else. Okay, I'll fry some of these now and then freeze them. So it's a really smart approach to making a lot.
Yeah, she did them in about four different batches. And, you know, as much as she says she doesn't want to do them, I know that when she's serving them, she feels incredible. She feels excited and she feels pride. And I love the way that my friends feel that they're like being mothered. I mean, it's a really sweet moment for our family when she does that. And then my dad is doing the vodka and it's pretty fun.
Oh, is there anything like weird about your like toppings or anything, any like must-haves about the recipe that your mom's recipe has?
About the toppings or no,
just the recipe itself. Maybe is it just straightforward or is it
any
secrets?
Oh, it's very sweet. It was actually based on Marine Sorosky's recipe that she had, and it uses matzo meal, it uses eggs. She uses a vitamin C tablet, which is kind of a holdover. A lot of people use citric acid to make sure that the potatoes don't gray.
Okay.
So she'll do that if she does that. But the thing that's a little trick with hers is that she grates them. She uses a food processor, and she'll grate them on the shredder, and then she'll pulse them with the blade, and so that they get a little, they're kind of this texture of sort of large rice grains. And that way, when you fry them, that's what separates them from being latkes, as opposed to sometimes if they're too shredded, they sort of come out like hash browns.
Yeah.
So you want to use russet potatoes because those have a lot of starch and they make them very crispy.
Okay, good
to
know.
That's very traditional. Okay. Yeah, very traditional.
And the toppings are applesauce and sour cream or anything?
Applesauce, sour cream. Sometimes we use ikura, so we'll use fish roe, and or smoked salmon is also really something we love to do.
Love it. I know that it's holiday, you know, winter time right now, but your paella recipe in here looks pretty darn good. And I don't know, I think of that as a summer dish, something to look forward to in the summer. But
yeah, I think we have a lot of recipes that go between seasons. Mm-hmm. You know, when we were thinking about how to organize
right.
it. So we have two porchetta recipes. One, which is a big porchetta, which might be very nice for people for Christmas, actually.
And that's from Sarah Jenkins, right? Or
There's one by Sarah Jenkins, and then there's also one by the Gail and John Priory, who own Foreign Cinema in San Francisco. So those are two. You know, one is sort of a big giant feeds 30, and then Sarah's is one which actually uses a pork butt. So they're two different cuts of meat, but those are very celebratory and can be summer or winter. And then we do have some summer recipes. We have Rick Rogers has a really lovely root beer spare rib recipe, which is great for the grill. And also we have that paella recipe, which you mentioned. This summer it was magical. That paella recipe is has all kinds of, you know, typical paella has a lot of fish. It's from Valencia, Spain, and and that one is actually that's one where you have to make it for a big group of people.
Yes, right. You're not going to finish that all. It's so fun. It's fresh.
But it's also one of those centerpiece dishes where, like the timpano, where you bring it out and it's this beautiful, you know, colorful dish, and you put it out and people exclaim, you know, with awe. It's part of the fun.
I love that. And if anyone has seen The Big Night, we all know what kind of, you know, catharsis could happen, you know, community
exactly.
building, if you will, and infighting
yeah.
and so forth
yeah.
Through just a wonderful, memorable meal. I love this idea. This comes from Elizabeth Pruitt at Tartine Bakery. She made a cheesy loaf, a huge loaf of cheesy garlic bread. And it looks like it's cut so that you can just pull like a nice chunky wedge out of it. Tell me a little bit about that one.
That is one of the easiest, most delicious recipes in the book. And what she does is she takes a levain bread or a big round circular bread and she cross-hatches it. So, you know, it almost looks like a tic-tac-toe board.
Mm-hmm.
And then she pours butter and cheese and garlic. And then you put it in the oven
Brilliant.
For 20 minutes, I think. And then you can literally pull pieces out of it. And I once had, at the soup swap, I thought, you know, this is the centerpiece. This is the thing you put in your middle
right.
of your table. And my daughter just could not stop. She had butter all over her mouth for the rest of the night. It's insanely delicious.
Love it. And you could just have like many different soups. I see in the photo you have tomato soup here. Just something simple to dip it in. Or not. We're just
Yeah, you could just eat that. That could be it.
I love it.
You know, Elizabeth is an incredible, incredible cook, and her cookbook, Tartine All Day, so some of these books, these recipes did originate from other books, but then we had to scale them up, know, and then we made sure that the chef and cook signed off to make sure that we did it correctly.
Well, I imagine, though, you can just get a nice loaf of artisan bread and then make your own tic-tac-toe board on it, and then you're done. It's a fun way of serving bread instead of just cutting it up for a side.
Yeah, it just adds. It's also a conversation piece. I mean, again, thinking about the foods we gather around, thinking about the mythologies around food, you know, the memories. When, you know, you make a big porchetta or you make something that's special. People, it's a conversation, you know, and there's a whole, as you say, there's a little bit of drama around it. There's a little bit of mystique. And there's a sharing because people are completely curious. How did you do this? And it becomes an event.
So what are some of those dramas that may have happened during your recipe testing dinners or any other events that where you're sharing these recipes?
Oh, in terms of things working or not working?
Or no, just some sort of, I don't know, connections that were made. Anything memorable that stands out?
Well, yes. There was a funny moment where we went to the Dolphin Club to do, we were doing a crab boil, and actually the photographer and I were scouting the space, and we met the chef, and he didn't actually know what was happening, and he was a little understandably confused by the fact that these two women were scouting the space, but had not actually gone through official channels. And at one point he said, well, you know, if you're going to do that, you can't actually do that unless you have a dinner for the club. And I said, that's great. So that's where we, instead of just doing some sort of a photo shoot where we, you know, invited our friends, we invited their friends. And I bought the crab, which Maria Finn actually at the time worked for this wonderful seafood company. And the crab is nominal. It was very inexpensive. And we had, you know, 200 people. And it was like a big night. And they were doing it during their boat maintenance day. But it was just, you know, one of those surprising moments during the process of doing the book where it opened up. What could have been a kind of, a situation to manage then became a complete advantage. And then, you know, we had an incredible meal. We had so much fun. We learned a lot about boats. And the photographs are in the book. The photographer, Molly DeCoutreau, is amazing. And she said, I definitely want to get pictures of the boats. I want to get pictures of the swimmers. I want someone in a Speedo. That's what I want to get. And it's just, there's a picture of a duck looking at a swimmer, which I think is not a food photograph. It gives you the feeling of the club, which I think is really fun.
So it's safe to say that these photos throughout the book, I love all the, you know, tableside photos, lifestyle photos, if you will, are real parties and real people eating the food, not like staged, right?
Most of them, yeah. Yep. I mean, it's part of why this book actually took a long time to produce, and it was very intense because, you know, getting a chef to come another day to cook with us, you know, preparing that much food. But most of them are real. Most of them are really fun. And what we didn't have as a party, we made a party afterwards.
Yeah, I just love how, you know, there's just so many heartwarming images of the chefs, Preeti Mistry. It just looks like everyone is like just having fun, though. One last thing, though. I notice you have not a chef per se, nor a cookbook author, but there is a meatball recipe from Francis Ford Coppola, and it's called Mama's Meatballs or La Polpette del Mama. How did you finagle that?
Well, so every year he has an event, which is a fundraiser for the North Beach Citizens Center, and it feeds the homeless. And I remember hearing stories about how he would make, you know, meatballs for 500 people. Again, this is one of those stories that made me incentivized to make the book. I just thought it was beautiful. And there was a piece about him in The Kitchen Sisters when they did Hidden Kitchens, and Davia Nelson and Nikki DeSilva. And so I worked with them on another project on their Hidden Kitchens book many years ago, and I reached out to them to see, you know, what their thoughts were. And it just is such a great, beautiful recipe, and it speaks to the theme of the book. And it was just an honor to have that recipe in there. And meatballs are like what you were saying about the Swedish meatballs.
Yeah.
It's one of those recipes which, you know, everybody loves it, you know, and it doesn't, you just make the pasta, you make the meatballs, make a big green salad, done, you know? It's inexpensive, relatively inexpensive to make for a lot of people. And it conjures. The Italians, in general, have a lot of big food. I had so many Italian recipes. I had so many recipes in general that I wanted to include in this book that I couldn't, but maybe volume two.
Hey, maybe volume two. Well done. I think that there's an amazing variety here. We only just scratched the surface of it. So really, everyone check out Feed Your People. And it looks like that's about all the time we have today. But thank you so much for joining us, Leslie.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
All right. And thanks for the meatball recipe. I think I'm going to make it tonight.
It's a good one. Yeah. Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you. And thanks everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks again.
Next year, Heritage Radio Network is turning 10. For the last decade, we've been committed to bringing listeners around the world the very best in food radio, for free. Our small staff and incredible network of hosts work hard so that listeners can tune in each week to hear the important conversations in food policy, stay on the cutting edge of cocktail culture, and hear the latest updates in food tech. But there is no HRN without the support of listeners like you. Become a member of Heritage Radio Network today and help HRN get a strong start to our second decade. Choose from exclusive member gifts and stay in the loop on discounts to upcoming events. There's no better time to show your support. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and wish HRN a happy birthday.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.